No, actually, I had to fight with myself not to put him back in the Santa Anita Derby 3 weeks here. At Santa Anita, he was ready to run the week before we left. He's a growing, healthy colt, and I don't see anything to worry about.
And also, you know, getting to Churchill early, to me, there's a lot of positives associated with it. What historically in your Derby tries, what has been your practice, and is there anything you're doing differently this time around?
Yeah, I've studied Bob Baffert a lot. He's my neighbor here at Santa Anita, and I walk through his shed row and take notes, or his walking ring every day and take notes.
I love it. Well, it's exciting, and you know, and for Rick Porter too. I mean, Rick has had his Derby chances. Certainly, got to be a lot of satisfaction to you know, go to Churchill Downs with the Fox Hill and give them a real chance for yourself and for him.
No, couldn't be more excited.
Well, and Richard, I would have to also get your feel. As I mentioned when we started talking, I had thought about reaching out to you for some reaction to the situation at Santa Anita, and things seem to have stabilized somewhat, and some feelings about where things are and you know how things might proceed from your vantage point.
Well, the concern at this point is we're on pretty delicate ground, and things do happen in this business no matter what you do. You know, sometimes things just happen. So we have to hold our breath and just hope we get along here with a smooth road for a while. But, you know, what happened this winter, probably the best way to explain it, we had the perfect storm. The weather was just unbelievable. We've been in a drought for 15 years, and I think a lot of us trainers might have forgot how to get along with the mud here in California. The mud in California is different than back east. Back east, the tracks are sand, and they take rain, dry back out. Sometimes they actually get better with rain. Ours have a lot of silt and clay in them because we're in a desert here, and you can't have them as sandy as back east, or they'd just be so cuppy they couldn't get around. And consequently, when it rains, it's not as simple to work with as your sandy racetracks in the east. So I'm saying that probably a lot of mistakes were made all across the board. Racetrack, trackmen, horsemen, and that's what I meant by the perfect storm. So, you know, it's everybody is scared to death to make a mistake now. So I think it couldn't be a safer environment than it is. Just hopefully, just some crazy thing won't happen and push us over the edge, because we're on a delicate ground here with the politicians and the animal rights peoples and you never know. Sometimes it takes a catastrophe to make people wake up and realize some changes need to be made and get it better. And let's hope for that.
Well said, Richard. And I really appreciate the thoughtful approach. And you know, I saw your quote at one point early on in when the circumstances with the cancellations. And you had said, who could ever possibly have, you know, believe that we would, you know, we would be in this situation, and I remember it sort of grabbed me at the time as being exactly right. I mean that you know, you'd have races like the Big Cap and you mentioned the San Felipe earlier. You know, having a day like that scuttled at Santa Anita. So it's been a trying circumstance. The week I spent out there, I mean, people, I never felt worse for people than those first few days leading up to Derby Day, Richard. I mean, the way you could feel the tension in everybody, in every horseman, and every employee, and no one should have to work under that kind of pressure.
Yeah, and it's, you know, quite a bit of that's going to be with us for a while. Like I say, just because of the pressure that we're under now. So we got to just hope that we keep getting it right.
Well, knock on wood. Well, a different kind of pressure. 3 weeks to the Kentucky Derby, keeping Omaha Beach happy and healthy, and work them a couple of times between now and Derby?
Yeah, no more than that. Won't be much.
Well, we...
if he ain't ready now, he ain't going to be.
That's There you go. There you go. Well, I'm excited for you. And how quickly are you going to get a decision, do you expect, on Mike Smith?
I'm sure in the next few days. Yeah.
I don't know. Feels like he's headed your way, if I had to guess. Richard, it's always a pleasure, and especially under these kinds of opportunities, the Arkansas Derby win and vying for Kentucky Derby favoritism in 3 weeks. Thanks so much.
It was my pleasure.
Richard Mandela, Hall of Fame, and boy, you know, think about that. Now that I mentioned Hall of Fame, how many Hall of Fame? Let's take a look at this. Well, while we wait for Jimmy Jerkins, John White's going to join us, and Steve Crist in this third hour. And while we keep trying, Jolene, Jimmy might take a couple of tries sometimes. But I'm looking forward to talking to Jimmy. Here we go, and you've got, let's see, you've got Mott, you got Mandela, you got Baffert, you got Asmussen, you got McGahee. Mott, Mandela, Baffert, Asmussen, McGahee, that's five Hall of Famers. And Baffert's got three, so that's seven horses. Right? Did I get that right? Obviously, Todd Pletcher's going to make the Hall. He's got the two. There we go. And how about a son of a Hall of Famer? Jimmy Jerkins is going to join us. And Jimmy added a very nice grade one to his outstanding resume that could knock on the hall door before it's through. This came in the Makers 46 Delta Prince. Jimmy, congratulations.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
This was exciting. This was a good group, and it was an interesting race from a pace standpoint. You had to figure that Heart to Heart and Great Wide Open would vie, and that's exactly what happened. What was your thought going in with Delta Prince?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think outside of those two. I didn't think, you know, you could just take your pick of who would be third, fourth, and fifth behind them, you know, looking at the form. But and Old Horse broke sharper than it usually does, which I was glad to see. But, you know, Javier decided to ease him back going into the first turn. And I didn't think he thought he'd end up being that far back after he did it. But once he's a weird horse that way, if you take a hold of him, he'll spit the bit on you like that, and you'll lose a couple of lengths before you realize it. But he didn't seem to be too nervous about it going down the backside. He thought they were really rolling ahead of him. It looked like it by sight that they were, but the time really didn't show it. But anyway, at least saving him was the thing to do,
as it turned out. And I mean, then when Javier pushed the button, he came flying, and it wasn't even, it was over with 100 yards to go.
I know, and he was drawn away by two, or just about two. It was really something, you know. It's just one of those, I thought he was doing very good going in there, and the fact that he broke with the field this time, I felt really good. But then after that happened, turning down the backside, I was kind of scratching my head. I was just hoping, well, hope it works out. Hope he knows what he's doing. But that's Javier, though. When he gets on a streak like that, he's, you know, he's so confident in what he does, and, you know, it seems to always work out.
He won with him, if we go back to Woodbine last June, he won the King Edward going the mile. Right. But, of course, that's the one turn. And he's now 5 for 8 with 2 seconds going the turf mile. you ran him in that Pegasus World Cup, and of course the Stronach team, you know, with the opportunity in that spot, stretching him out to a mile and 3/16. Frankie Dettori rode him, and it sounds obviously like he's a bit of a tricky horse to ride. Knowing what Frankie probably knows now, maybe you could have won that race.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. He put the horse kind of put himself in a kind of way out of it, you know, by breaking kind of slow. And then, you know, when Frankie decided, well, he says, well, when he started to kick in, he says, well, I don't want to stop his momentum. And he ended up making a pretty good, sustained, wide move on a turf that wasn't very firm. So, you know, it's a shame it just told on him a little bit at the very end, but I still thought he ran fantastic.
And that's kind of dirtied up when you look at it. You know, meanwhile, here he is, a 6-year-old, and you know he's been judiciously campaigned. He got a late start to his career. Bring us back to the beginning with him. He's a street cry out of the wonderful Delta Princess, the AP Indy mare, and in fact, Riley Mott put up a couple of very funny pictures of her going berserk during a saddling at Saratoga. But this has been, you know, this, once he came to hand, once he broke his maiden, I mean, he's been very effective when you've spotted him.
Yeah, he has. You know, he's had his issues along the way. Obviously, you see a lot of breaks in his career. But you know, if you get him over there, he's very willing to training in the morning. You know, when you get him over there, and the gate opens up, you know, he's going to give you his best. That's for sure.
Well, this is a huge win for him. I mean, multiple grade one placed and now a grade one winner. And as a street cry with that pedigree, he's gonna stand in an Adina operation at some point.
Yep. Yeah. You know, the only regret is I think we did try it again, and it still isn't totally out of the question. You train him and work him on the dirt. You can't believe how good he works on the dirt. The only thing is he hasn't been able to, only the two starts that he's had on the dirt. He's overreacted really bad to kickback in his face from the dirt. So probably the second time I ran him on the dirt, it wasn't the greatest spot in the world because it was only 7 furlongs. But before it's all said and done, I'd really like to give him another crack at a decent dirt race, because that would mean just that much more when he goes to start, you know, because he trains sensational on the dirt. It's not like one of these turf horses that, I don't think I can breeze him because it rained and the turf's not open, you know, for turf works. That doesn't even come into it at all with him. It never has his whole career. You know, he has no problem working on the dirt. So that would be one thing I would like to see if we could do before it's all said and done, and get a good-looking race on the dirt.
Well, and given that pedigree and given the way he traveled in the mile and 3/16 race, if you could get the modifieds, you know, in a race like the Whitney or something, you know, he'd be, you know, with a grade one win on turf already in his pocket, I'm sure the Stronach team would love to see him in the Classic.
Absolutely. You know, but like I say, he's one of those few horses that just react. If you just look at the two reruns of his two races on the dirt, it's almost comical. He's jumping from it so much, he's like leapfrogging from the dirt hitting him in the face. He still finished third against a nice bunch, True Timber and that, which was,
yep.
He didn't run 3 yards in the race and still finished third. So it goes to show you, the winner of... I can't remember his name, escapes right now. Arnaud Delacour's horse won it, and
no,
he won pretty easy. But he finished ahead of some decent horses without even running 3 inches the whole race. So, you know, his talent is definitely there on dirt as well as turf.
Well, he's got 4 triple-digit figs on the grass, and we'll watch and see and let you. You know, let you pick out some spots, but Delta Prince, in just his second start of the year, is a 6-year-old, only his 13th career start overall, and for right now, he's you can pencil him in toward the Breeders' Cup turf, but we'll see. You know, and speaking of grass, Jimmy, Keeneland, with that sand-based course, not everybody takes to that turf course. Was there any concern about how he'd get over it?
Well, I didn't know, don't really put much into that. I just try to get him over there as good as I can, and then just whatever happens, happens. I try not to weigh too heavy on that stuff. Obviously, it is a different course than some others, because that was a nice horse, especially the horse at Kieran's. I thought he was sitting in the perfect spot, and all his races, good quality starts, all his races. And he was coming up, he was all he could do to hang in there for a check, and so something about it is pretty tiring. So Javier, obviously he did the right thing by easing him back and just letting him try to come back to him. He knew it better than I did, that's for sure.
Well, and Castellano riding just terrific right now as well. And in fact, he swept the grade ones at Keeneland this weekend, winning on Rushing Fall as well for Bob Edwards and for Chad Brown. I got to bring up, because we didn't get a chance to talk earlier in the year, you had that dental surgery, so I couldn't talk to you. What was that? Was that after Holy Helena, maybe?
No, that was... Well, that was right before, I think Mijos had won the Mucho Macho Man is when I had
There
it
you go. There you go.
Yeah.
So we haven't talked this year, and there's lots to talk about. But I do want to mention, you mentioned Mijos, obviously Rocketry and the long association with Centennial. But the Stronach, that you've been training for the Stronach stable group now, and this has really been a nice client for you, and you've really given them a lot of returns.
Yeah, it's been good. I was lucky enough to get, when I first started, I trained for them about 15 years back for a couple of years, and I thought it went well. And then, they at that time, they decided to race mostly in Canada again for a few more years. And then when I was getting, he called me back himself and said, would you be interested? And I said, sure, we're going to Florida. And I thought I was just going to get a bunch of, horses off the farm, that the young ones that had just turned three. And I got a couple of nice horses off the farm right away. I got Charmin Ghost, and I got a horse called Unbridled One, who's still running around now in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
He's been gelded, but he's been running good. And and a couple of other nice ones I wasn't expecting. I thought, I wasn't told I was getting the seasoned horses. I thought I was getting the young ones. But, I was thrilled, because this was a little slow at the time, too. So, and I got lucky that we were able to get them going and did good. So, and it's been pretty good ever since.
Well, and that includes the wonderful Holy Helena, who was Queen's Plate and Woodbine Oaks winner, and you've got her in nice form.
Yeah, she's been good. I think her next start will probably be the Sheepshead Bay on Derby Day. It'll be trouble finding. I don't know. I couldn't begin to tell you who's going to ride her, because no one's around. So. It seems like every jock in the world has is committed to going to Kentucky. So, but maybe Lascano. I hope I can get Lascano, but he's not sure. He's not 100% sure he's going to be here. But if he does, he'll know. We'll know soon enough, and that's who I would like to ride.
How much longer is she going to? She's going to campaign through the end of the year,
It seems like it now, because she's still here. There was some talk over the winter about, I think Mrs. Stronach said a few things to me, like she thought she was going to be bred. But, everybody sees her. She looks, she's not over-raced. I mean, she's run hard, but not, she's had good little respites between her starts most of the time. And she looks gorgeous, and she sounds so... And she went down and ran good right off the bat. So I think after her last race, the decision was made to keep her around. See if she can. Who knows? Maybe she can get a little more done in the grade one category. But You know, as long as she looks like she's in good shape and no soundness issues, we're gonna run her another year.
Outstanding. Let me ask about another favorite out of the barn, Rocketry.
Yeah, his last race was better than it looked, I thought. I was teetering back and forth of whether to run him in that race. We ended up running him in the Pan American on the turf. You know, the distance of the Pan American was certainly more up a valley, and his turf races are good, but I just didn't, you know, I didn't know how good it would look running and putting him back on the turf after he's 2 for 2 on the dirt. So it's kind of in a, kind of in a spot there. But then turned out the dirt race didn't set up for him at all. So again, he tried to kick in with his finish, but the horse is up ahead. You know, he's very deliberate and lumbering early on in his races, no matter what you do, wasn't much pace in the race, and every time he tried to gain, they just went up ahead of him every bit as fast, so he couldn't make much headway. But I thought he put in a decent effort, and we'll probably look to run in the race called the Flat Out early May at Belmont.
Excellent. And you mentioned Mijos. Let's stay with Centennial a minute. Where are you with him?
He had a little setback after his after the Holy Bull, but nothing that was in no way career threatening. He went off his feet a little bit, and just a combination of little things. But he's starting back now. He's starting back galloping, and he'll probably be breezing again in another couple of weeks. He'll have his first published breeze.
Nice. So, but no, there's no targets.
Not really. Not till we get going and see how. I wouldn't expect him to take long. He's not one of those horses that bellied down and got heavy during his time off. And he's one of those natural athletes. So, I think he'll come to hand pretty quick.
And while we're on Centennial, too, I want to ask you about an older horse that I've always thought, you know, there's going to be something to him. Preservationist, the Arch, what is he? Is he a 5-year-old?
No, he's a 6-year-old now.
6-year-old.
Yeah, but he's had a lot of nagging things, obviously, in his career. He's a very, very big horse. Very talented, which is obvious. You know, he's got, for his size, he's got feet that are very small and narrow. He's had a terrible time with quarter cracks with him over the years. Matter of fact, that's what happened to him the last time. And he did have a little ankle trouble last year also. But we got him patched up again. And, you know, we tried different things, different shoes, different, you know, a lot of different things to try to, you know, keep the walls of his feet strong, but he's just he's so big and kind of hard on himself. He's just hard to keep much continuity with him, which is unfortunate because he's a definite stakes quality horse, and it would mean a lot if he could get some kind of black type with his pedigree. It's a terrific pedigree all the way down on the female side. But we're not giving up on him because he's very, very talented and very willing. So hopefully we can get him back.
Well, and also, let's also talk about, I don't believe that Skywriting's not Centennial.
No, but he's owned solely by the Horvitzes, which are big investors in Centennial.
Okay.
Peggy and Peter. Yeah, he ran good the other day. He's kind of a hard horse to maintain, though. He's kind of light, a little too light for a colt, especially that I'd like to see. But he's still young, and we're probably going to give him a little break now. Just to see if he can get his stuff together and fill out a little more. And then I'm sure we'll see the best that he has to offer. But I, I, Both his races so far have been incredible races. So we think ultimately he'll be a nice horse.
You know, saw that race last week, and it, of all the horses to get to have beat him, Jimmy, to have Orb finally breaks his maiden for Buzz Beeler, but it didn't. He had moved on by that point.
Yeah, well, it was. Let's kind of made a decision to ease back off him, which that's just probably serves our horse best in the long run, but. Looked after clearing the chute there that we might have been able to get the lead from him, and then who knows, or might not have been quite as brave. I don't know, but it's hindsight's 20/20. But I was glad to see him making slight headway at the very, very end. That was encouraging. So looked like he was going to get beat a good 5 or 6 lengths, at the 3/16 pole, but then I thought he was making a nice second effort at him, which was good to see.
Well, I'm referring to Orb, the Jimmy that you had for a portion of the career, and I was happy for Buzz too. At the same time, he spent a lot on Orb, and it was nice for him to break his maiden. That was okay.
Yep.
You gotta be happy for everybody. So, beyond that, you came out of the winter with a few maidens that should graduate pretty quickly.
Well, see, who do we have? Who are you?
Let me go back to my notes and. And fine, I saw a couple of thirds here and there. Punchline, that Punchline from last week.
Well, he stayed up here all winter.
Okay.
He ran in New York. Yeah, we were really happy with his race the other day because first time he ran awful green, and another horse that just wouldn't run up against the dirt at all. He almost stopped so fast when it looked like the jock almost got dislodged. So first time, but he. Raylo's been working him a lot during the winter and always liked him, so he was kind of hoping that the horse would put him in a position to keep him a little more out of the dirt. We didn't show quite the speed we were hoping, although he's not a three-quarters horse, but again, I wanted to sprint him one more time before we stretched him out because I just wanted to get him going again. I thought he needed the experience, but I thought he ran very well against the at least much better than he did the first time. He still didn't like it down in there, but he faced it. He faced it and dealt with it much better than he did the first time, and I thought he ran very well.
Well, between the stake horses and the couple knocking on the door, it should be a good spring, and it was a nice winter. Jimmy, well done on the grade one for Delta Prince, and looking forward to getting back to Belmont too. Certainly was an okay winner, but it just feels different when we get back over to Belmont.
Yeah, it does. And then Saratoga is not far behind. So, we're excited. With any luck, we should have a decent year. Yep,
absolutely. And great to catch up with Jimmy. Jim, thanks so much as always. We'll see you soon.
All right, Steve. Take care.
Jimmy Jerkins and the Grade One win. And some others, including Holy Helena, hadn't had a chance to talk about her and hadn't talked to Jimmy about Mijos either. So you got an update on everything going on in the Jerkins barn. We're staying right here, and we've got about 35 minutes left to visit with John White, and we'll close out the morning with Steve Crist. And Steve will join us to talk about his long relationship with Steve Davidowitz, who we lost yesterday at 77. John White is joining us, and as we talked it was Tuesday, right? You came over on Tuesday morning to Santa Anita last week?
Yes, Tuesday morning, that's right.
Well, so not a week ago, but 6 days ago, and we said once we got through with the Lexington and with the Arkansas Derby, we'd be able to focus in. John, what were your thoughts about the weekend?
Well, first of all, it's kind of an honor to follow Mr. Jerkins because not only is he an outstanding trainer in his own right, but I'm such a huge fan of his late father, who I think was one of the great trainers in the history of this sport. You mentioned Secretariat earlier today and how Steve Davidowitz was so relentless in trying to right one of the biggest wrongs in the history of this wonderful sport, and that was Secretariat getting robbed of that track record in the Preakness. And lo and behold, it took many, many, many years, but they finally did right that wrong, and Secretariat now credited with that stakes record. It would have been a track record at the time, but now he holds the stakes record for the fastest Kentucky Derby, Preakness, and Belmont. One thing that's kind of a interesting twist about that, though, is people sometimes forget that it was the robbery of the track record in the Preakness that set the table for the greatest performance of my lifetime, at least I feel that way. And Secretariat's 31-length Tour de Force in the Belmont Stakes, but Ron Turcotte has told me, and I've seen it, him quoted elsewhere, you know, he would have wrapped up on Secretariat once he opened up a 15-20-length lead in that Belmont with the rest of the year. And back then you had to deal with handicap racing where they really actually put weight on horses. And the reason that Turcotte did not wrap up on Secretariat and he kept pumping him all the way down to that finish, he was running against the clock. Once Sham cracked, for Turcotte, his goal was not complete. And I asked him, did you try to look over and see the time on the teletimer? He said, absolutely, and there's a famous picture of Turcotte looking over to his left, trying to see the teletimer, but Turcotte has said, I didn't want them robbing us of another record. Hmm. So it was the robbery in Baltimore that set the table for the 31 lengths at Belmont. So in a way, I'm kind of thankful that Secretariat got robbed, but Steve Davidowitz, to his credit, was just, he never gave up on that, and he was certainly vindicated. In fact, it was even faster than they had thought. The racing form had its clockers, including Frenchie Schwartz, one of the most respected clockers in racing history, had Secretariat with a time that would have been a track record. Andy Beyer and many people knew that the timing was, the first time they put up on the board was completely ridiculous. I mean, it made no sense at all. And but it turns out it was even faster than it was thought to be at the time. But then you mentioned Secretariat, and it's Alan Jerkins, who of course famously beat Secretariat twice, with Onion in the Whitney and then Prove Out in the Woodward. So and that's just not even a small taste of what Alan Jerkins, the chief, accomplished in his career. So like I say, it's an honor to follow anyone with the name Jerkins. And then, of course, Richard Mandela on your show earlier, you say, what was my takeaway? I've been on that Omaha Beach bandwagon ever since he won that 7-furlong maiden race in the Slop. It just looked to me like the light bulb went on that colt that day, that he just turned things around and took everything to a much higher level. And I know they liked him a lot last summer, and it was just one of those situations where it looked like he didn't want to win races early in his career. Well, that went right out the window when he won that maiden race in the Slop, because not only did he win by 9 lengths, but I'll tell you, Steve, what impressed me the heck out of me, it was the opening up by 10 before he got to the eighth hole that day. I mean, he just, and like you point out, one bad boy was in that race. Michael McCarthy had a horse in there that he was high on. I mean, And this Omaha Beach just made those horses look like, you know, nothing, and that wasn't the case. That's how well Omaha Beach ran. And the ride that Mike Smith gave this colt in the Arkansas Derby, I mean, this is yet another masterpiece in the Mike Smith lexicon of masterpiece rides. And I thought Ortiz rode Improbable great, too. I mean, you couldn't have really ridden Improbable any better. He got him out of the gate after Improbable had acted up in the gate. He got him out to the outside. He made the move to take on and push him, Omaha Beach on the far turn. He got, looked to me like within about a neck at the head of the lane, and Omaha Beach then put away that bid. and had a length lead at the eighth hole, but Improbable never gave up and kept after him all the way down the lane. But Omaha Beach just held him at bay, as you put it, and that's the perfect way to put it. And I love the Omaha Beach gallop out. I mean, there's just nothing really not to like about Omaha Beach. He's got an outstanding trainer. He's got a terrific pedigree. He's got the right racing style. It looks like the mile and a quarter will fit him very nicely. He's proven on a wet track, so you don't even have to worry about that. I mean,
yeah.
At this point, I mean, all you have to do is hope he gets a decent draw, really, to me, on the first for the race on the first Saturday of May, and he's going to be awfully tough to beat in that race.
I think all you got, the other thing to worry, not worry about, but to watch for is the Smith decision. For those that might have missed it yesterday, Ortiz committing to Tacitus, which, isn't a surprise. Much more opportunity for Jose Ortiz to ride for Bill Mott, obviously, day to day. But it kind of feels like the quote unquote right choice for Smith is Omaha Beach. I'll be surprised if he goes the other way.
Well, it's a toughie, and it's an enviable position, and Smith famously, or maybe not famously, but at least to me, I recall very vividly, let's put it that way, back in 1995, he rode Talkin' Man, who had romped in the Wood Memorial, and he'd ridden Thunder Gulch, and he had to pick between Thunder Gulch and Talkin' Man, and he picked the horse that 99 out of 100 people would pick, and that was Talkin' Man. But that left the mount open on Thunder Gulch, and Lucas reached out to Gary Stevens, who was in Hong Kong.
Right.
And Stevens had won the Santa Anita Derby on Larry the Legend in a photo finish. And by the way, it looked like Larry the Legend was going to be a big-time player for that Derby, but he got hurt. It was known right away out of the Santa Anita Derby he would not make the Kentucky Derby. And so Lucas reached out to Stevens in Hong Kong, and Stevens was very unenthusiastic because he felt that Thunder Gulch was kind of this lugging in colt. All you got to do is go back and look at that rim cinder. That's one of the worst lugging in jobs I've ever seen for a horse. And Stevens just was very cool to the idea. And Lucas, to his credit, to show you one of the reasons he's a great trainer, is he called Mike Smith and said, "Hey, Mike, you better tell your buddy Gary Stevens that this mount's open here on Thunder Gulch, and he better take it up because this horse could win the Kentucky Derby." And so Smith called Stevens and said, "Look, Gary, he'd ran a bad race in the Bluegrass, but if he runs like he did in Florida, he could win that race." And lo and behold, it's not Talkin' Man, but Thunder Gulch that Mike Smith could have been on, but instead it was Gary Stevens. And he was riding kind of a very emotional victory that day because Mark Kaufman, who was a good friend of mine for many years, we worked together at Longhorns, and was one of the national people known in the publicist department and worked Breeders' Cups and Triple Crowns and so forth, and a very good friend, of course, of Gary Stevens. And Mark had just passed away, and so that was a very emotional win for Gary Stevens. But I say that because there's one of those cases that Mike Smith looks back and he goes, "Darn it, I wish I would have stuck with Thunder Gulch." And it was interesting to me to hear Gary Stevens yesterday talk about who he thinks Mike Smith should ride and who he feels he would ride, and it was Omaha Beach. And I think that surprises a lot of people from the standpoint that, a lot of people just assume because it's Baffert that you're going to ride for Baffert. And that could still turn out to be the case, but I'm sort of like you, Steve, at this point. If I had to guess, my guess would be that as long as Omaha Beach in the next couple of days here is in good shape, gets the Churchill fine, and he seems fine, and the reports were that he came out of the race beautifully, I think that's the way he'll go. But it's an enviable position in a way, but it's a tough position to have to pick between those two. Because Roadster, we know how high Baffert's been on him going clear back to last summer.
And until we just brought it up here, I hadn't really thought about it, but it's a little hard to imagine that 19 days from the Kentucky Derby, Bob Baffert needs riders potentially for both of his for two of his three horses. It's unbelievable.
It's a year after the guy won his second Triple Crown.
It's very funny. I mean, and listen, he's got go-tos. Between Talamo and Drayden Van Dyke, and you know, I suppose Drayden at this point properly admonished for. You know, for a couple of wide trips, and maybe that message was driven home, in the last couple of weeks since the trip to Sunland and so forth. But we'll see what happens. Improbable and Roadster.
I will tell you this, Steve, on Drayden Van Dyke, the ride he gave Improbable in the Streets End Stakes last year, because I bet Improbable in that race big. And he didn't break well that day. And I'll tell you what, Drayden was in all kinds of traffic in the first furlong or two down that backside to Churchill. And I'll tell you, that horse got a lot of schooling out of that race that day. But Drayden just masterfully was able to keep. I mean, there were a couple of times, some riders might have clipped heels. I mean, it was that dicey a couple of times in heavy traffic. And Drayden just skillfully was able to negotiate his way through all that heavy traffic and win that race big that day. So, you know, while there have been those that kind of knocked Drayden for his ride, in Arkansas, I will say that that was a superlative ride he gave that colt to Churchill. And that was at Churchill, too. And that's never to be taken lightly, that horse has got a good race over that track.
Well, and while we're on this topic, you made me think of two different things. I'm just going through my list. I think we've got six horses that are currently within the body of the Derby field. And yeah, here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Is that right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I mean, technically, I'll pencil Smith in on Omaha Beach. Roadster needing a rider and Improbable. Cutting Humor, both of the Pletchers actually need rides. Cutting Humor and Spinoff and Gray Magician it does not have a rider assigned. And actually, there is a sixth. I'm not sure where is Country House? He's going to need, because Rosario will ride Game Winner, right?
Yep.
So Country House is going to need a jock. So six of the, basically 30% of the field without riders, which is a little unusual. And there's plenty of candidates floating around, including Giroux and Leperoux and so forth. We'll see.
Well, Bob Baffert was asked about this in the last few days, of course, as has Richard Mandela and Mike Smith himself. And Bob made the point, and it's true. He says, look, if I've got a good horse, I'll be able to get a good rider. And,
yeah,
you know,
that's
that
not
is
a problem.
Truth. I mean, you know, Bob's not like sweating bullets over this. I mean, he's more concerned about how the horse is doing and what kind of horse he's taken to Churchill Downs. I did want to mention that while we've been focused on Omaha Beach and the Son of Warfront, the horse I brought up on your show last week that's slipped through the cracks a little bit, and in fact, Andy Serling just completely scoffed at, which I chuckled at because that's what I want. I want people to scoff at this horse, the War of Will, with another outstanding workout for Mark Cassie, 59 flat from the starting gate, with fractions of 22 and change, 34 and change, 46 and change, galloping out at 111 and change under Tyler Gaglione at Keeneland. I'm going to tell you, these last two workouts for War of Will, and I just love it. This, you know, Johnny Diaz said, well, you can't win the Kentucky Derby without any hiccups. Well, as I mentioned, Secretariat 2 weeks before the Kentucky Derby had a big abscess in his mouth and was able to get over that in 2 weeks. You just heard Richard Mandela talk about the quarter crack that Omaha Beach has had to overcome this year, but most people weren't paying any attention to that because Omaha Beach wasn't on the radar at the time. But it isn't like everything has gone completely smoothly for Omaha Beach this year. And people are going to jump ship off of this war wheel just like they jumped off Thunder Gulch that I just alluded to when he paid a huge price winning the Kentucky Derby. And like I say, I have such respect for Mark Cassie. If there's a trainer that can have this horse primed to run, and, you know, maybe the horse isn't good enough, you know. You know, from buyer speed figures, he's going to have to raise his game when you look at like a 101 for Omaha Beach. But I know how high Mark Cassie's been on this colt all along, calling him a superstar. And this is just one of those great value opportunities. I mean, the price you're going to get on War Wheel is going to be so inflated compared to what it would be if he had won the Louisiana Derby. And if he doesn't run into that fluky thing about four or five steps out of the gate in New Orleans, you know, he might well have won the Louisiana Derby. Maybe not, but he might have won it. And if he had won it, he'd be considered one of the top, you know, three, four, five
right.
favorites for the race.
Yeah. No, no doubt. No doubt. I watched the work and actually talked to Davey Carroll, too, about it. He certainly worked a mile, basically. And you don't have to worry about the soundness. He's sound. It's going to be a confidence. It's going to be a personal confidence circumstance in making that decision. And by the way, since we're on the jockey topic, and I'm not going to get a chance to really delve into it in detail today. Paco Lopez, again, yesterday in the nightcap at Gulfstream, if you didn't see it or hear about it. Paco Lopez forcing himself out off the turn, wins but gets disqualified, and is like a human battering ram. I don't know what it's going to take to teach him. You know, this after what transpired with Romero Marat, hard to believe he would pull a stunt like this. And it's very lucky that there wasn't a heel clip incident. Yesterday, if you didn't see this, the 11th yesterday from
I did happen to see it, actually. I haven't seen very many races at Gulfstream this year other than stakes. I did happen to see that one. And, you know, the big crime to me on top of what everything you just articulated, he was on tons the best horse. This was so unnecessary. Mm-hmm. I mean, if he rides more patiently and just waited a little longer, you know, it wasn't like... You know, this horse was just full of run, but instead of, like you say, being a battering ram, if he just waits a little bit, he's probably going to get somewhere to go. I mean, this horse won so easily. He was so much the best. Even if he'd been bottled up, you know, deeper into the race, once he gets clear, considering how superior he was, he would have won anyway. So, I mean, it was completely unnecessary.
And I'll discuss this with Tony on Thursday, and I'll make sure Tony sees it. If you're going to do that, if you want to force your way out, you don't do it on the turn. I mean, it's already a dangerous concept, but don't do it on the turn. If you want to try to, once everybody straightens for home, and now you're okay, that gives the guy to your outside or your inside, whatever it is, it gives him a chance to but not on it. Don't do it on the turn. He's got to be dumb as a brick. I'm sorry. Anyway,
that was very bad, Steve, and it was dangerous, and it was a very easy call. The only tough thing for the stewards was trying to determine how many horses were affected. That was the thing that they had to determine how far low to put the horse, but there was no question the number had to come down.
Now, John, I appreciate it. We'll talk next week with 2 weeks out from Derby. We'll get final thoughts on the points system and the strikes, and we'll get some more analysis when we visit next week. Thanks. I'll talk to you from Churchill.
Take care.
Going to wrap up the last 10 minutes this morning, and Steve Crist is going to join us. We started the show with Andy Beyer, and perfect bookends, really, in this first opportunity to remember Steve Davidowitz, who really affected, I got to say, I imagine that everybody my age, around my age and younger, has read betting thoroughbreds and read pieces from from Steve, heard him maybe on this show the 5-6 years that he was on weekly with me. Steve Crist, of course, a colleague, and spent time editing, undoubtedly, Steve's work too. And Steve, really an outpouring from horse players and colleagues, the sadness over the passing of Steve Davidowitz. Steve, did we?
Yep,
there he is. There's Steve Crist. Steve, this one shook everybody. Really, no notice about Steve, but really, really very sad. He contributed to all of us who care about the game.
Well, he was really an influential figure early on in handicapping. I kind of think of Steve as the link between Tom Ainsley, when he was really the only handicapping author out there, and just before Andy Beyer, who I understand you had on earlier, and he talked about their relationship. But betting thoroughbreds was really one of the first modern, intelligent handicapping books that got people interested in the game, as, you know, Andy's books later did, and that I think people think of as an important influence on their early handicapping knowledge.
From your experience dealing with him, and when you read Betting Thoroughbreds in the various cantations that have come along, what struck you about Steve's approach that was new and it was valuable to people that they might not have found on their own?
Well, you know, Steve was one of the first people to talk about concepts such as track bias, which is not something you read about in Tom Ainsley's work, and he was really one of the first people to articulate that as a concept. Steve was also very proud of having invented the term key races. And remember, in the days before published speed figures, you needed tools like the idea of key races to judge, you know, whether a maiden race, whether you'd just seen the hopeful winner or a 25 claimer, by studying how horses came out of the race, and they did. And I know this stuff sounds very fundamental now and things that we take for granted, but nobody had articulated and published these concepts before Betting Thoroughbreds. I also was very pleased that one of the things we were able to do at the Racing Forum when we ramped up a book publishing division was to have Steve modernize and update Betting Thoroughbreds. I think we called it Betting Thoroughbreds in the 21st Century, where he went back, he revisited all the concepts that he had talked about then, and published a book that is still a very good first book for people who become interested in racing and handicapping.
So true. And for me, Picking Winners and Betting Thoroughbreds were the first two. And I, as much as I love Picking Winners, Steve's book hit me, I don't know, where I live, I suppose. I mean, there was nothing about that I had to figure out, Steve, if you know what I mean. I read Betting Thoroughbreds and then read it, you know, several times again, and certain chapters that I would go back to, and I just felt like, you know, I by osmosis, there wasn't anything in it necessarily that I needed to practically apply, but I just felt more aware of the game after absorbing it.
Yeah, and I think that his book and Picking Winners were really for that generation of people, or people who came of age as horse players then in the 70s, that it made following this sport and becoming a handicapper a very attractive thing, which it might not have been in the past. That you read those two books and you said, wow, this is something that, you know, smart, respectable people find interesting and really enjoy pursuing, and maybe I should learn more about it and become a handicapper too. And I think Steve was very influential in that respect.
And he had... He had in his writing, whether it was specifically a handicapping piece or if it was, he wrote that book, it's got to be 10 years at least now, The Best and the Worst of Thoroughbred Racing. I mean, he had such a love for the game's history and the great races. And, he relished telling those stories. And, you know, he traveled extensively to Sunland and Canterbury, his experiences there in particular. You know, Minnesota, I don't think there's a player in Minnesota that doesn't look to Steve as their fountainhead for understanding the game. I mean, they brought him to Minnesota.
Was brand new there.
Yeah.
And Steve went to the Minneapolis Star Tribune as their turf writer, and that was, you know, really the only paper in town. And it was a great fit for him because it was a whole new racetrack and an audience that had never been exposed to racing before. And Steve really became the guru for people who wanted to play horses in Minnesota.
Exactly. And, you know, he would come to Saratoga. And I know, you know, it's funny, Andy Serling will be with us tomorrow. He's traveling back from his broadcast work at Oaklawn this weekend. And boy, Steve, you should have seen. Hot Springs went crazy for Andy.
Well, that had all the earmarks of my cousin Vinny, but I understand it worked out very, very well and sounded like he had a great time down there.
He did. That's a great reference. But Andy will talk about it. I mean, he as wacky as Davidovits could be, I know that Andy enjoyed having him when he would do Talking Horses. I mean, when you do it, and have over the years, it really Andy always sparkled under those circumstances. He said, you know, Davidovits, you'd go toe to toe. He had opinions, and he wasn't afraid to, you know, to bet them. He wasn't afraid to drive them home.
No, he absolutely was. He was fearless with his own opinion. He had a great affinity for the Hopeful Stakes. He always wanted to do Talking Horses with Andy the day of the Hopeful. He'd usually make it up to Saratoga for closing weekend, and he'd do it then. The other thing that I really remember about Steve and that was so helpful to many of us turf riders, again, you have to remember an era where there was no internet, there was no access to replays of races. And Steve would host a little party derby week in his hotel room in Louisville for all the turf riders where he would play us all the derby preps. And many of us had never seen these races around the country. That was the nature of the era. And Steve had gone to all these tracks and gotten, you know, video cassettes and put them together. And it was just an amazingly helpful thing for all of his colleagues to be able to see those races. And it was, you know, very generous of him to host this party and to share with his colleagues these races, which very few of us had seen at that point in the year.
I've never heard that story.
Yeah, it was an annual event, and, you know, you had all these young turf riders, you know, myself and Randy Moss and Beyer, and it was just this great tool. I know it's hard to think of an era where we hadn't all watched these preps, you know, a dozen times, but it was the first time that a lot of us had gotten to see those races.
Well, and I do remember, I think it's in Betting Thoroughbreds, where he says the VCR is the most important innovation in handicapping in history. That the ability for us to watch, you know, races that way, and, you know, that reminds me of the era when we would all order the two VHS tapes for Breeders' Cup, and we would see all the races for the Breeders' Cup preps, and it was the only way to do it. It was the same
way.
Yeah,
it's hard to remember a time when you didn't know who had had a trip in the Hollywood Derby or the Illinois Derby, and that was the first time we got to see those races. So that was very helpful and generous of him.
That's a great element of this. Well, Steve, I said to Andy, this kind of thing can make people feel a little older. There's a you know, there's a sense of mortality with a passing like this. There's a lot of people saying wonderful things, and Steve's impact will continue on for all horse players and forever.
Certainly one of the giants of handicapping literature.
Well, happy to have you and Andy pay fitting tribute to Steve, and I'm sure the rest of the week people will as well. Steve, we'll talk to you as we get closer to Derby.
Very good. Look forward to it.
Steve Crist, everybody, and a great book ending back and forth from the beginning to the end today with Beyer and Crist, their longtime associate and colleague, Steve Davidowitz. More as the week goes by. I know plenty of people, virtually everybody, will, on the pundit side, will have a story or two. But that's a good one, a viewing party for Derby. I never heard that. Andy Beyer, Steve Asmussen, Johnny D, Richard Mandela, Jimmy Jerkins, John White, and Steve Crist today. Thinking about Case, who's got another, I don't know, Joe, another night in the hospital, or might get home today. What do you think? What's the good word? Yes? One more night or home? Well, we hope it's home. Oh, today, good. So Case will be home and hopefully get him later in the week, but no matter what, a tremendous job again by Jolan on the glass. Recap continues tomorrow. We still got plenty more to talk to. Rudy Brissett, Rusty Arnold. I got to get to Brad Cox, and I mentioned Andy. And it's opening day at Indiana Grand tomorrow. We're going to kick off some conversations with Bill Downs. And since it is Triple Crown season, I also want to mention that the Match Series, which starts Saturday, is sponsoring Triple Crown coverage. Replay tomorrow, 6 to 9, here on Sirius XM. Hope we'll get the archive and pod up on the website later this afternoon, too, when Casey's up to that. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow.